This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. So, one debt crisis over, setting the stage for debt crisis number two in December. And this time, Jill, Senate leader Mitch McConnell has said essentially, don't expect us to help you again. So where does that leave things?
Is he the ultimate boy who cried wolf? Didn't he say that? I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it would be bad. This is the proverbial kick the can down the road, if I may use that hackneyed saying, because obviously on December 3rd, we've got to figure out what is going to happen, and Congress does have to act. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell have basically said, you know, it's like they're shrieking on the sidelines saying, please do this, please do this. This could be catastrophic to the U.S. and the global economy. And, you know, what would really happen in that moment is the U.S., if we only made, let's say, a partial payment, a couple of things would happen at once. One is that all of a sudden there would be downgrades to U.S. debt. That happened back in 2011. And it was followed by a four-week sell-off in the markets, in the stock market. Stock market went down 14% in the subsequent 4 weeks. That would be about 4,800 Dow points. That would not be fun. But more importantly, there would be a mass amount of confusion in the bond market. And probably the Federal Reserve would have to step in to this and start buying some of these bonds that people would be unloading. And it would just be chaotic and would be horrible. I don't know why we continue to do this to ourselves, but here we are again.
Would the ATM still work at least?
Yes, okay. It would. But all your right. Money would probably be worth less.
Okay. Explain this thing that's happened over the past couple of weeks. The IRS, after all these reports about rich people stashing away unreported income, wants banks to provide transaction data on transactions worth $600 or more. And this seems to have people up in arms as a privacy violation. Is it?
No. How about that? In a word, no.
Okay. Well, why not?
First of all, there's precedent for this. After 9/11, there was a humongous change to the way that we monitored transactions. Okay. And this was all around anti-money laundering, or AML as it's called. And the reason that we're concerned about this is that we want to understand where is the source of funds for bad actors. Where does that happen? How does that happen? You know, if you like look at old Sopranos episodes, you're like, oh, there's a dry cleaner and, you know, like some cash business like a car wash that becomes the way to launder money. There are many more sophisticated ways to do that through the banking systems, as we're learning because of these papers that were recently released. But I think that the government is, and the Federal Reserve as the regulating body over the U.S. financial system and big, huge banks, should be able to say that, of course, we want to see that, you know, where cash is coming from. And by the way, if you just deposit cash into your account, it's not illegal. It is just a way for them to say, like, we want you to track it. And we want to know, where is this money coming from? And if you declare it on your taxes, great. And if you don't, you're going to get in trouble.
The problem is there's a lot of money not going reported. And the estimates vary wildly depending on who you ask in the Treasury Department. But I'm a little surprised that Congress has a tough time actually trying to collect the money it's already owed, even without raising tax rates.
Well, I mean, it's ridiculous, right? Because they've siphoned off the money from the IRS slowly but surely over 20 years. So if you don't have resources, you can't do this work, right? So, yeah, you want to go get the money. But a lot of the things that were released in those Pandora papers, they're not illegal. I mean, that is the other aspect of this. You know, it wasn't necessarily illegal what many of these folks were doing. They were taking advantage of laws that allowed them to park money in certain places, like the state of South Dakota, and have a very liberal interpretation of what rules should be applied to trust companies there. And then they kind of go and do what they want. So if you're going to have a disjointed policy where 50 states have 50 different ways of interpreting trust law, that's going to be a problem. And it's going to open up Pandora's box. Get it?
Maybe that's why it was called that.
Yeah,
finally, why are so many people, especially women, not going back to work?
This is a great question. There's a few reasons. Number one, I think that obviously the Delta variant really spooked a ton of people, and especially those working moms who have primary responsibility for taking care of their kids under 12 who are not vaccinated. That's spooky, right?
Yeah.
So that's number one. Number two, there are real issues around childcare. I spoke to a woman who said to me, she's like, I'd love to go back to work, but the daycare that I used to go to closed. It didn't make it through COVID. I can't find babysitters. Like there's a labor shortage in the childcare market, and I can't afford to not take care of my kids. So I'm home right now dealing with this until there's a more regular schedule. And then there's the other part of this, which is a lot of people are simply limited in terms of getting to where the job is. Now, that can mean that, okay, I live in New York and there's a great job, but the job is, you know, in another borough, right? I live in Manhattan and I can't get to the Bronx. But it can also mean I live in one part of the country that is still sort of sitting underneath the cloud of COVID, and I can't afford to go to a different part of the country where there's a job. So this mobility issue is quite significant. But I think it's the childcare more than anything else.
Yeah. So is there anything Congress could do to help with that? Like,
well, there's lots.
Maybe subsidize.
You know, amazingly, there's a bill that is, that is sitting waiting for Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema to say no to.
Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Merck has announced the development of a new pill which can treat the symptoms of COVID-19 after you start suffering from the disease. Let's call in the doctor.
Patient Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, you've been calling for a therapeutic like this for a long time. It sounds like, based on the Merck study, that this is sort of like taking Tamiflu. So what do you think?
Dave, that's a good analogy, Tamiflu for COVID patients. Yeah, you know, all along I've thought that the answer wasn't necessarily a vaccine, but rather a therapeutic. First of all, when we first started talking about a vaccine, before we knew what would actually happen, just by looking at our historic compliance with vaccines, especially the flu vaccine, it's pretty poor. Like annually, just under 40% of people get the flu vaccine. So, you know, there was all the talk about developing a COVID vaccine, but you and I talked about the concerns over actual compliance. Would people actually get it? And if so, how many people would actually get it? And we're seeing now that for, you know, a whole host of reasons, the country's become very divided over whether or not to get the COVID vaccine, and it's been a problem. And also there was the issue of how effective would the vaccine be, because we use the example of HIV. It's been around for 30 years, and we still don't have a vaccine. So we do have a vaccine for COVID, but it's not really as effective as we initially thought it was going to be. And so these were the sort of problems that you and I talked about that I think were sort of anticipated and have come to be true. Now there's a therapeutic, and I've always thought that this would be what was ultimately necessary, that really you would need something that was inexpensive, that could be taken at home, not necessarily in a hospital, in a pill form that would treat COVID if you got it. And in fact, here it is. Merck has finally announced the development of the first of what will probably be a series of pills that will come out from different manufacturers, but Merck's ahead of everyone else. So they're asking for approval of, or at least emergency use authorization of, a pill that they've developed and a study that appears to be effective in certain patients, a certain subgroup of patients they studied, who have contracted either mild to moderate COVID.
Okay, now, what's interesting about this study to me is that the pill was so effective. The difference between the group taking the actual drug and the placebo group was so pronounced that they decided it was not ethical to continue with the placebo group, and they just started giving everybody the pill. So does this work on any COVID patient, or is it only indicated for certain types of patients?
So they only used it in a subgroup of patients, and it was people who had mild to moderate COVID, but who had risk factors. They were high-risk patients. So they had comorbid things like either obesity, hypertension, diabetes, or whatnot. But they were people at greater risk. But the interesting thing is that this entire group was unvaccinated people. And so that's part of the reason that there was the necessity to end the study early.
So is this a newly developed drug, especially for COVID, or is this one of those drugs that's been out there for a while and they just happened to discover that it was effective against this virus?
No, this drug was specifically developed for COVID. Now, the thing is, it's sort of interesting about it, and I've sort of wondered, people who've been resistant to get the vaccine, one of the complaints, or the main complaint has been, well, the vaccine came out too fast, and it wasn't studied on enough people. And so who knows what's going to happen if we take it. If they believe in what they're saying about the vaccine, then they're going to have the same complaint about this.
Well, I get your point. The people who didn't trust the vaccine because they didn't think it was tested enough would probably not trust this because it's only been tested on a few hundred people. I think the difference, though, is that you give this drug to people who are already feeling, you know, their lungs start to fill up. And at that point, you're probably saying, okay, this is serious. Give me the pill.
Yeah, I mean, that would have to be the mindset or the logic that somebody would have to use in order to actually take it. The thing is, you know, what we don't really realize, but it is this issue about taking the vaccine isn't confined to just America. It's actually a worldwide problem. Hopefully the same negative press or, you know, won't come with the pill, because I've always thought that a therapy was ultimately going to be the solution. And, you know, here it is. It's not perfect. Nothing what we find is going to be perfect, but certainly this would be very good for people who aren't vaccinated, but even in people who have breakthrough cases, you know, it could certainly help to reduce the spread of the infection by getting people better quicker.
So given the need to ease the crunch on hospitals, how long is it going to take before this drug actually gets to people?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to be like the vaccine. I think it's going to be accelerated through the FDA. I mean, if they were willing to stop the study early, which is a pretty dramatic step, but it does happen, in all likelihood, it'll get approved pretty quickly.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Friends, family, and investigators are going to gather this afternoon to mark the 20th anniversary of the unsolved murder of federal prosecutor Thomas Wales in Seattle. KYRadio's Hannah Scott is here with the latest on efforts to catch his killer or killers. Hannah, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, 20 years this has been going on. And if you've been in Seattle for any time, everybody's heard of this case, this 49-year-old prosecutor, U.S. prosecutor from 2001, who was sitting in his basement doing office work when someone shot him through the window and has yet to be found or arrested. An investigator detailed what they had found out about that shooting back in 2018. When we had a big press conference here.
He was careful on the night of the murder to avoid setting off floodlights in the yard that were attached to motion detectors, leading investigators to believe that this was a carefully planned execution.
His daughter, Amy Wales, also speaking at that event.
My father's murder was an attack on the institutions of the United States. And for people with information to please share it, please come forward and share it.
Even U.S. Attorney at the time, Rod Rosenstein, was here.
It is not acceptable that that killer remains unpunished.
And then Mayor Durkin, who used to work with Wales, also was at that press conference and shed light on the fact that they believed that at that time they had figured out, they believed this was more than one person involved, some sort of conspiracy perhaps, and that that would be the downfall eventually.
It is human nature to talk. Everybody talks to somebody. The people who are behind this, who did it, talked to somebody.
And it appears to some degree that that's sort of what happened. The most recent information we had on the case was from back in 2019 when a Marysville woman became the first to be arrested and charged in this case. It was with obstruction of justice for lying to a grand jury at the time. It turns out that she had a connection to somebody who was named in court documents as suspect one. Now, that's according to the Seattle Times. That woman apparently used to date suspect one, who the investigators now believe is very likely a hitman who was hired, they believe, by the longtime suspect in this case, who has always been a pilot from Bellevue, who Thomas Wales had unsuccessfully prosecuted for a fraud case. It had something to do with altering of a helicopter or a plane. That case, he lost. It never ended up doing anything. But the theory has always been that this pilot was perhaps a drug smuggler, ties to cartels, and that at some point after that failed prosecution attempt, he was still upset that that had happened and had gone to the cartel asking for help finding someone who could be this hitman for them. And they could never connect the dots, really. And at this point, the Seattle Times reporting this morning that it seems that they have connected the dots, and the dots are the cartel, that there is a small drug ring up in the the Kitsap County area, I should say, and that it's that that ties, that you have that, then you have this pilot, and in the middle, you've got the cartels. And that's what they believe. The connection is not enough of a connection yet to have made an arrest, but that's the theory that they're working on, and apparently going to be issued, getting a memo to the prosecutor in the federal prosecutor in New York, who is going to help them go after some of the folks who know about this for obstructions, thing like that, to kind of shake some trees.
So is it your impression then that we're going to see some movement on this pretty soon?
It's more information than I've ever seen before. Again, though, a lot of this is theory. I don't know how much of it you can prove. There's quite a lot to it, though. There's a very lengthy story in the Seattle Times this morning about how they connect the dots. So if you read through, the truck that was stolen from this gentleman who was in this circle, they believe that person who stole that truck is this suspect one. They seem to know who that is, a 52-year-old man in Snohomish County. I'm not clear as to why they don't have enough to make any sort of arrest there yet. There's clearly some more work that needs to happen.
Well, I mean, I think I know. If we're talking about a cartel,
right?
They're pretty ruthless people. I'm a little surprised that they would participate in a hit on a prosecutor, because that turns up the heat in a way they usually don't want, right?
Right. Absolutely. So you would think that that wouldn't have been the case. I know in the Times article, it says that perhaps the alleged possible hitman maybe wouldn't have known who the hit was on or anything like that, but it seems to me that the cartels would have. So yeah. And both of those people in the cartels have since been prosecuted and deported on separate charges, these two connections that they had here locally in Western Washington.
Yeah. And Jenny Durkin worked in this case, is that right?
Yes. And she's always been passionate. She knew him quite right. Well. And she'll be among those who are at Thomas Wales Park today. They will, I believe it's a Japanese maple tree that they're going to be planting in honor of his 20th anniversary of his death.
Pretty soon she'll be free to devote full time to trying to find the guy.
Yes, she absolutely will. Yep. And I know she's quite passionate about it.
Here is Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. When a teenager couldn't afford to go to the homecoming dance, she found help through a kindness yard sale. CBS's Steve Hartman has this story.
14-year-old Marjorie Gonzalez is about to go shopping for a homecoming dress.
Let's shop.
Susan Thompson Gaines is more like a godmother, a fairy godmother, who just magically appeared in Marjorie's life moments ago.
Just came out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere to conjure up a dress for the ball.
All right.
Like all fairy godmothers, Susan's wish-granting process begins with rags.
This ugly Christmas sweater.
Old clothes, racks of them, mixed with a dash of footwear, a pinch of gold, and a dollop of just about everything else. Each part of the potion donated by Susan's neighbors here in Arlington, Virginia.
So many people helped. It's everyone in the community now. Like, every inch of our space was covered in treasures.
And then all of it sold in a giant yard sale. This was her third annual.
And here's where the story gets good. In the coming months, Susan will use every penny of the profits, more than $12,000 this year, to fund random acts of kindness throughout her community.
In the past, she has bought donuts for nurses and left flowers at veterans' graves. She has delivered presents for Santa and thrown a beach party for dementia patients. Really, hardly a day goes by that Susan doesn't do something, because she firmly believes that kindness begets kindness.
This mission has taken over your life.
It totally has. Once you start looking, there are opportunities everywhere.
Like the high school girl who couldn't afford a homecoming dress. Susan let Marjorie pick out a favorite, along with shoes, jewelry, everything but the Prince Charming.
It's made me overall a more happy person.
So you picked up something from the yard sale too?
I did. I picked up a lot of things, but that probably is the most important. Yes.
A brand new box of purpose. Best yard sale find ever. Steve Hartman on the road in Arlington, Virginia.
Seattle's morning news. Pinch hitting on today's Gian Ursula show from 9 to noon is Aaron Mason, certified Beatles fan. And did you hear about, this is this a snippet I want to play you from a BBC podcast coming out in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's Paul McCartney. This is their teaser. They revealed the latest on this 50-year-old argument over who ultimately broke up the Beatles. Here it is.
John walked into the room one day and said, I'm leaving the Beatles. I didn't instigate the split. That was our Johnny. Come in one day, said, I'm leaving the group.
So there it is. That's it. It wasn't Paul.
Well, then. That was our Johnny. Yeah.
I love the accent.
Love it. Liverpool. Everything
oh,
up
you're
and
so
down.
Good. Oh, are you thanks, part of the Henry. Halloween radio play coming up? We need that accent.
No, no. Talk to Felix. All twist right. his arm for me.
Jeez.
I keep trying to chirp in his ear. No, this is, I mean, look, this is fascinating, right? Like, we're still, if you are a Beatles fan, you're just hungry for more, right? All the time. And if you're
I'm
not.
I'm surprised you care. Were you even born when Sgt. Pepper's came out?
No, no, no. I was born in 1980.
Okay, so that.
Yeah. Actually, John, I was alive for about 2 weeks, and then John was killed.
Yeah, that's sad.
But it, to me, it's fascinating because I as a musician and lover of music, went back and discovered the Beatles, you know, as like a teenager, mm-hmm. and really couldn't believe what they were doing, and then to know that they did it decades ago, like they're just revolutionary in a way. So I think you have to hold somebody up as the example or the focus of whatever it is you're talking about. When we talk about popular music in the 20th century, when we talk about rock and roll and that kind of music, well, the Beatles, you know, you just say the Beatles. They're the best. They're number one. Rolling Stone magazine is going to give either them or the Rolling Stones that title. But do you believe this? I mean,
I was going to ask you the same thing as such a Beatles fan.
I don't.
I do. He kind of was going out on his own anyway, having.
It's not surprising, but it also sounds convenient. I think John was definitely sure. over being in the Beatles, but I think all of them were. And this is just Paul being like, well, don't you can't hate me, love. I didn't do it. It was
You're
Johnny.
So good. Oh, Johnny. Listen to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a pretty popular the rock and roll meme though, right? The girlfriend breaks up the band.
Oh yeah, absolutely 100%. And while that is true in a lot of cases, because you've got if you listen to people who are in successful bands, they'll tell you it's like a marriage,
yeah.
right? And there are those same relationship dynamics, those same give and takes, those same compromises, that same sort of effort you have to put into watering that garden, if you will, to introduce another relationship into that or parallel to that really can destroy yeah. both of them.
The other thing with the Beatles, and they've released in the years following their breakup, some of the outtakes, you know, you hear their process, they were really struggling. I mean, they were under such pressure to keep coming up with stuff because they were so insanely popular.
Yes.
You could see that it was really taking a toll on them, and they were just throwing everything on tape that they could.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what a bar to try and reach,
yeah.
one that's so high. I am very excited about... What's it called? Let It Be, the new documentary that Peter Jackson is putting together. Peter Jackson is probably most famously the director of the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Right.
And he and his people have pioneered some very, very incredible restoration techniques. Mm-hmm. And so there was that movie they did about World War I when they took World War One footage,
they colorized it,
and colorized it, and filled in the frame gaps, and so it looks like it was filmed last year, right?
That was
and
amazing.
So that is apparently what they have done. It's going to be a mini series on some streaming network, where they've taken the last several years of the Beatles and all of that footage, and is going to present it in a newly restored. I've seen the trailer. It looks absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I'm sold.
I would
wow.
I want to see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that Netflix?
I can't remember which service it is. It might be Hulu.
Hulu. Oh, I don't have Hulu.
Yeah. Oh, you got to get Hulu, Dave.
I know. It's like $3 a month.
You got to get all of them, apparently.
I don't
know,
but so many. $3. Well, I really get my money's worth. Anyway.
To watch The Handmaid's Tale, to watch the Beatles documentary. Uh-huh. Yes.
Aaron Mason filling in for G this morning.
Good talking to you guys. Yeah, I love being here.
It was a terrifying day for many kids and their parents at Judkins Park the day the CD Panthers were playing a youth football game, and suddenly gunfire rang out. Kyrate's Hannah Scott and Converge Media's Omari Salisbury are with us now with an update on the situation there. Omar, you had called for the community, I know, to take a stand. So, Hannah, you tell us where this is now.
Well, first of all, Omari and I had the chance last night to talk with Coach Elmore of the CD Panthers, who tells us, first of all, what it was like to be there that day.
You know, you can hear from afar a couple pops, pop, pop, you know, and then it kind of, you know, as they used to say, it sounds like fireworks. And then it kept going, pop, pop. Then we hear a second pop, 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 and that's gunfire. And everybody just started to just run. We're in an open field. We don't know if it's a field, where it's at. We just know it's close. And unfortunately, we were celebrating Grandparent Day. We were having grandparents come down, and not only did we have the kids down there, we had elders down there.
So it was a tough day, and it was Omari, when we talked to him, he shared about his own daughter being down there as part of the cheer team and some really big struggles.
Yeah, no, for sure. First of all, thanks for having me on here this morning. Continue to uplift the CD Panther program and what community is doing to combat gun violence there. You know, it's what Coach Elmore brought up is that unfortunately, of this issue of gun violence is generational in the Central District. He talked about, you know, this is something he confronted as a youth growing up in the CD and going to Garfield High School, and something he wanted to protect his daughter against. And, you know, his daughter was out there, one of the people who were impacted. You know, these young people already, a lot of them already face a lot of challenges and everything else. And then when you've got something like this, it impacts not only them, but, you know, family members and community.
And we got to hear about how law enforcement had responded, because the community did come out. He had asked for some security folks. We talked about the evacuation plan. But I asked him last night, what about what are you seeing from the regular channels from the cops? And he was pleased with it.
Law enforcement was great. Chief Diaz came down there with officers, undercover officers, came down there and secured the park, walked around the park, had discussions with parents. Bought ice cream for the kids. They had an ice cream machine. They gave the kids ice cream and parents ice cream all day. We have a few politicians that came down to the field, talked with the people. They told them their frustrations. So, you know, hopefully the message gets to make it downtown that we need help. We need resources. You know, we're a preventative organization.
Now, here's what he means about the importance of being a preventative organization. And I've talked about this before, but it can't be said enough.
We're there in the preventative stages. And before they get to getting into making bad decisions, and hey, we're at ground zero for everything. We want to shoot those resources to those kids at an early age. We're having issues with funding. We're having issues with securing fields, paying for uniforms. All this stuff comes kind of just off the backs of our board. We're continuously making this thing happen, but at some point in time, it would be nice to fall into those grants,
and
fall into help.
Amari, you can elaborate on some of that, the preventative part where he talked about instead of the diversion programs and things like that we sometimes talk to once a kid gets into trouble, this kind of stuff was about keeping them out in the first place.
Yeah, no, definitely. And real quick, if I could hit on one thing, is that, you know, it was real interesting that Saturday up there at Judkins Park, what Coach Elmore mentioned right there, the Seattle Police Department did come out. They were out there. A lot of the black cops that know the neighborhood were there and patrolling the field. And you also had a big turnout of community that called for black men to show up. They showed up and showed out. And you had a lot of people who came up there to Judkins Park. So you kind of had a hybrid there. You had community protecting community. You also had the Seattle Police Department over there in the general area on the field. And what Coach Elmore means right here is CD Panthers is indicative of other programs in the city where he really says it's ground zero for prevention. And listen to what he's saying right here is this is a program. They got 150 youth in there this year, ages 5 to 13, young boys and young girls that are bare bones, barely make it by on anything over there. And, you know, they continuously, they don't turn any kids away at the CD Panthers. And this is preventative. You know, we invest a lot of stuff in intervention, which is important. But you know what? If we can uplift programs like the CD Panthers and other around the city that are 100% preventative and they're dealing with our young people, our youth, and keeping them on the right track, coaching them, mentoring them, and everything else, they just need support.
Now, Hannah, the city just sent a few million dollars to various organizations to do, I believe, research, right? Did any of that money get to programs like the CD Panthers?
I think the short answer is no, right, Amari?
No. You know, you got a few things here. Is the city has put out some funds. The majority of the funds are around intervention. There's some things, you know, there's a bunch of different programs. The short answer, correct, though, Hannah, is no. But also, though, I would say this, is that, you know, this is the CD Panthers and what they face and other organizations face. Government doesn't necessarily have to be the answer. Seattle, a city of 800,000 people in the surrounding area, 3 million people in the county. We got a big enough heart in our city and our county to be able to support programs like the CD Panthers. We don't always have to turn to government. You know, I mean, I'm sure there's little league programs across our region that maybe have an abundance. They can understand when there's a program with mm-hmm. They might not have jerseys, they might not have helmets and things like that. You don't have to be a sports fan or somebody like that. You don't even have to be in government, red or blue or anything, to understand that programs like this need uplifting. And we, the people, can do that. We don't necessarily have to rely on government.
Absolutely. And it is important, I think, for these folks, is given what happened too with the shooting. One part I did want to share that we didn't get to is that a lot of the kids, some of them haven't come back yet after this. They don't feel safe. And the coach had shared with us a story about one family in particular where the sister had come back, but the brother had not, doesn't feel safe enough to, is just really rattled. And they don't have anyone to talk to, no one professionally to talk to who can be there to help except for coach, of course, and things like that. But it was surprising to me when he said it was the sister's oldest brother. He was the older of the two siblings, mm-hmm. and he didn't feel safe, but he was, you know, his sister was going back, who was the youngest.
Mm. Well, I mean, it sounds like the police presence was appreciated by the community. Is that correct, Amari?
Yeah, I mean, the players, the parents that were out there, definitely they appreciated Seattle Police Department coming up there. And those are officers that the guys know. You know what I'm saying? There was a lot of officers that are already out there in the community, a lot of African-American officers on the Seattle Police Department force. And the people also appreciated that their community showed up as well. It was a hybrid. That we don't see often. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of community to come bring the peace and the police.
So a lot of good things that day.
Excellent. Well, that's good news. And so it sounds like, Amari, you think it's time for the community to raise some money. If you put something together, just let us know, okay?
I'll definitely be doing that and shoot it over to you, man. And we appreciate the time and the support of the CD Panthers.
All and right, I'll have something good on My Northwest a little later for anyone who wants more information on how to help the CD Panthers.
Anna Scott and Amari Salisbury, thank you both. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.